Well, welcome back. I'm very happy to tell you we've got Kevin Muir on the line with us here. Kevin was one of the key speakers at the World Outlook Conference that we had this year at the Bayshore Hotel. I've been reading Kevin's weekly letters for, well, I guess it's at least 5 years. And then a couple of years ago, he went behind a paywall on Substack and I became a subscriber. I really like the things that he has to say about markets. You know, last week we were talking with Greg Weldon, and one of the points I made about Greg was that he was not only an analyst, but he was also a trader. And Kevin's the same. You know, he maybe he's first and foremost, he's a trader, and then he writes his thoughts about markets. But anyway, enough of an introduction. Kevin, thanks very much for taking the time. Glad to have you on the show with us today.
Oh, it's always my pleasure to be with you today, Victor.
Now, Patrick, I'm going to call you Patrick. I can see that. Yeah, you and your partner, Patrick Terezna, do the market huddle. That's one of the things you do. Take 2 seconds and tell us about the market huddle.
Well, the market huddle is our it's actually we've gone to every second week now. We used to be weekly, but it was taking too much time. I have the great privilege of interviewing a wide variety of different guests. They're usually traders that are a little more sophisticated, and the topics that we explore are a little more kind of inside baseball. And then afterwards, Patrick and I kind of have some fun and talk about markets and enjoy ourselves and have a lighthearted kind of breezy conversation about all the things that have happened.
So that's at the market, call it markethuddle.com. Now, when we had the World Outlook Conference, we had the speakers dinner after that, and I know you came and you sat beside Joseph Schachter, who's been a frequent guest on the show. But one of the reasons you sat beside Joseph is that he was pals and worked with your dad years ago when your dad was head of research at Richardson Greenshield Securities.
That's right. I didn't actually realize because not only was Joseph working with my father, but he's also a fellow Winnipegger. Mm-hmm. And I always assumed because he started at Richardson Greenshields when he was in Toronto, and I always kind of thought he was from here, but it turns out that he lived in the same neighborhood and he actually knew the same people in terms of my father was the research director and the head of Richardson was a fellow by the name of Chuck Winograd, and him and Joseph were good friends way back when. And so we had a lot of fun reminiscing about the old days.
Now, I mentioned your dad because I know you've told me before that when you were a kid, you know, your dad at the dinner table would be talking about the stock market. So you got interested in the markets at a very early age. And then before you were done with university, you were working with one of the major Canadian banks on their institutional desk.
Yes, I actually have a kind of a funny story about how I got into the industry. I went and I actually started at Bank of Montreal Investor Line, which is a discount stock brokerage division. And I got there and it was at the start of kind of that whole process of people being able to phone up and trade for themselves. And they were super busy. And next thing I knew, I was the manager of this desk. And I said, well, I don't want to do this. This isn't what I wanted to do. I always wanted to be a trader, not an order taker. So I took up and I went to Chicago and I didn't like Chicago very much in the pits. And I came back and I still hadn't got my degree. And I was lucky enough to get a job on the RBC Institutional Equity Derivative Desk. And what I was the fellow that actually handled all the index orders and the basket trades. And my boss likes to joke about it. He says, Kev, there was guys that were better at computers and there was guys that were better at trading, but you were just the right mix of both.
That's a compliment. Now listen, your website is macrotourist.com. There's a bit of a self-mocking ring to macro tourist. I mean, why don't you tell us what a macro tourist is?
That's right. My tagline is all I bring to the party is 25 years of mistakes. I'm actually going to have to change that. I think it's probably been 30 or 35 by now. Macro tourist is actually a kind of a derogatory term that people usually use for traders that have kind of wander into a square, and it's generally a macro kind of trade. They don't really know what they're doing and they're just tourists and they put these trades on and they usually do badly. So I always thought that this was kind of a funny name, and people used to say to me, you know, Kevin, it's not a good thing to be a macro tourist. And I said, I got that. It's kind of tongue firmly in cheek.
Well, actually, I like the title because for me, it indicates that if you're willing to call yourself the macro tourist, you've got some humility. And for traders in the markets, if you're not humble, sooner or later,
the market will do it for you.
Exactly. Okay, listen, let's talk about some of the things you wrote lately. And as I say, you publish like an editorial piece. That editorial is the wrong term, but instead of just notes, you put something out with your opinions attached. And you wrote two articles recently about the correlation between stocks and bonds. Now, this could be a really dry subject, but you said it's probably the most important decision that a lot of people are going to have to make is what they're going to do in their portfolio with the relationship between stocks and bonds. So take it away.
So I actually think that this is the biggest challenge that are facing investors for the next couple of decades. And let's just step back and think about what the correlation between stocks and bonds means. Generally, in most of the period that investors have, modern investors have experienced, we've had what they call a negative correlation between stocks and bonds. And this means that when stocks have a bad, period, whether it be because of a crash or because of the economy does badly, bonds would rise. And by having that negative correlation, it means that if you are owning a portfolio that is comprised of both stocks and bonds, they will become the kind of mixing those two assets into your portfolio will have a dampening effect. When we had the 2000, the great financial crisis, and the stock market went down 30-40%, the bond portion saved you. Same with the 2000 crash. And even in 1987, eventually what happened was the market crashed, but your bond portion did really well. And that relationship has held for last 40, 50 years, basically ever since Paul Volcker broke the back of inflation. And it ends up being kind of a complicated reasoning of why that relationship might change. But if it has changed, and we do see a situation where stocks and bonds can move together, then a portfolio that is traditionally, let's say, 60% equities and 40% bonds, instead of that bond portion being something that, I would call a ballast to your portfolio, it actually might become the anchor that drags your portfolio down. And this is what we saw in 2021 and 2022. Instead of bonds kind of providing positive returns, they had two of the worst years ever. So not only were you losing on your stock portion in 2022, but you were also losing on your bond portion. And when you look at the 60-40 portfolio, it had one of the worst years in, I think it might have been almost 100 years. And if that relationship between the correlation between stocks and bonds has flipped for good, it means that people are going to have to think about their portfolios in a dramatically different fashion.
Well, we had interest rates hit, call it 5,000-year lows, right, in August of 2020. I think the 10-year Treasury yield was down to about 0.5%. We're closer to 4% yields now. One of the things, Kevin, that I've said on this show a lot is that with zero interest rates that we had for more than a decade, a lot of people who would traditionally have been savers had to do something else. They had to get involved in the markets and that sort of thing. And now that interest rates have gone back to like 5%, maybe on a GIC, people that want to be savers or should be savers have got, some motivation to put their money there and to get out of other markets as well. We've seen, for instance, the recent auctions in the United States with yields higher than they were previously. We've seen some pretty aggressive bids on the institutional side. And also I see foreigners are coming in and buying the bonds at these higher yields. But if you consider that for some folks, there's money moving into that market, but for a lot of folks that are listening to our show, I'm going to say, or I think the balance of our audience is maybe north of 50 years of age, and people, when they get older, they kind of get told you should have a bigger weighting in your portfolio of bonds than of stocks. So with that kind of an input, where do you go from here if you are one of those kind of people that has had this thought that, you know, the bonds will balance out any weakness I have in the stock market?
Right. As you get older, you definitely have to de-risk your portfolio, and you have to make it so that it's not as subject to the swings of the market, and you're going to need the money, so it needs to be invested in safer things. The real problem you're going to face is that, yes, interest rates have gone up now, and you're absolutely correct, Victor, to highlight that when they were 1, 1.5, or 0, there was only one way they were going to head. They were going to head higher eventually, and it was just a question of when. Now we have a situation where you can get 4 or 5%. But the problem is that you get 4 or 5%, and first of all, that's only at the what they call the short end, meaning that only if you invest for 30 days or a year or something. If you actually try to invest for 10 years and buy, let's just say, a U.S. 10-year treasury bond note, it's more like 3.5%. And the real problem ends up being that, what's the inflation rate going to be over the next 10 years? And if the inflation is no longer this kind of sub 2%, and we just saw a situation where we had inflation at 8-9%, then yes, you could be earning a nominal 3.5% for the next 10 years, but it doesn't really help you if you have an inflation rate of, let's say, 5%, which is what I think will happen. We will average somewhere between 4 and 5% over the ensuing decade. And so your what they call real return, meaning the return after inflation, will actually be negative.
Yeah, I'm certainly sympathetic to that. And I mean, the last couple of weeks here, the bond yields have been rising pretty steadily in the market. I guess if we go back the past couple of months, bond yields fell quickly in the aftermath of the banking crisis, if I can right. call it that in quotation marks, in the United States. But over the last 6 weeks or so, people have been recalculating, or maybe taking to heart what Paul Volcker keeps saying is, we don't plan to cut interest rates this year, folks. Getting inflation down is really important to us. So even though the market seems to be pricing the forward strips on the short rates, pricing the Fed to fall or lower interest rates, he's saying, no, we're not going to do that.
Right. And we're kind of at this dilemma because the actual economy is surprisingly strong. If you look at Wall Street and Bay Street, they keep anticipating a rolling over of the actual economy, and it's not coming. And what's happening is that as rates go higher, the market keeps saying, okay, well, now that this is going to cause a stress, that we're going to see a crash of some sort. And then when the crash comes, they will have to lower rates dramatically. And so we have this push and pull between an economy that ends up being stronger than folks expect, yet as they raise rates to slow it down, they become more convinced that we are going to have a crash in the markets or in the economy, and therefore rates will be lower. Yet it just doesn't, it's not here. It doesn't happen. And we have this, they call it the hard data versus soft data. Soft data are things like surveys and kind of asking people how they think about the economy, asking CEOs, asking, you know, people you phone up and you say, what are your plans to spend? And all those, that data is showing that the economy is about to roll over. Yet when we look at the hard data, meaning the actual unemployment and what people are spending, that continues to be hard and strong. So we have this dichotomy where we have soft data showing that the economy is about to roll over, but the hard data refuses to kind of confirm that. And this is the greatest divergence that we've had between the soft and hard data ever. And it's left a lot of investors kind of shaking their heads, wondering what to do. And you talk about the fact that the bonds were bid, meaning people were buying a lot of bonds because they were convinced that we were going to have a banking crisis and the economy was about to roll over and the Fed would be, you know, cutting interest rates. Well, if you actually look at what's priced in for the Fed cutting interest rates or the Fed's forward path for the next quarter, it used to be kind of a month or two ago when the bank crisis was running high, they were starting to price in the chances of a cut. Well, guess what? We're now pricing in almost 100% chance that they're going to raise by 25 basis points over the next two meetings.
Yeah. So there's the short-term view on things, and then there's the longer-term view. I know you and I have talked about the bond market before from a longer-term perspective, and it just seems to me that the government and the people who vote for the people who form the government are just kind of sanguine about the prospect of deficits. Right. That, you know, we don't need to balance the books, you know, and for we could go into modern MMT, modern monetary theory. And it seemed to me that that was kind of predicated on the notion that MMT would be fine so long as you didn't get inflation starting to run away.
Right.
And it would seem to me that if we're going to continue to run government deficits, and that will mean we will have higher than normal inflation, or I should say the inflation that we've had over the last 20 years. And if that's the case, you certainly don't want to own bonds.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the MMT and that kind of distinction about the change in attitude about spending is ultimately why I believe that we are in a secular rising inflationary environment. Just rewind back to the great financial crisis when Obama was there. And we had all this collapse in the economy, and everyone was convinced that the problems were too much debt. There was this famous book by those two economists called Reinhardt and Rogoff, and it was the perils of spending too much and how this creates a financial crisis. And everyone cut. And even though the private sector was cutting, the government also cut. And the Obama with the Tea Party and the sequestration, they were actually forced to cut. And that's why the ensuing recovery was so weak. Fast forward to 2020, and we have the COVID crisis. Yet this time they come and they realize that if they just cut rates, that's not good enough. They need to actually spend. And you referenced MMT, that, you know, with the help of understanding MMT, they said we need to do fiscal on top of just monetary stimulus to get us out of this hole. The problem is that they did way too much fiscal. Mm-hmm. And it's actually one of the problems of MMT is that people aren't being honest about this, that they've done too much. Yes, fiscal is very powerful, but it was almost too powerful. And it was always, the MMTers will always say that we have no financial constraint. We have what's called a real resource constraint, which is basically you can spend until you create inflation. And at that point, you need to cut back on your spending. Well, the trouble was that we spent all the way up there and we just kept going. And it's not only that, it doesn't look like it's changed. If you go look at there's no more Tea Party. Even though they're arguing a little bit about cutting back on the spending, on the whole, governments throughout the world are spending more and more, and that is why we are getting more and more inflation.
And the people who vote for those governments, pardon me, that's what they want. They want the spending.
Right.
I think a book for the period that you were talking about was Gary Schilling's book, The Age of Deleveraging. And Gary Schilling was a huge bond bull, stayed bullish on bonds for 20 years. He had a hell of a run. From the Volcker period of time when interest rates were 15 to 20% down to August of 2020 when they were essentially 0.5%, it was like the greatest bull market ever, I guess, in the bond market. And it's over. And you're saying it's over, like it put a fork in it. It's done.
Right. And listen, that doesn't mean we're not going to have periods where inflation goes back down. Like we're in one of them right now, even though inflation is showing 5% on a year-over-year basis. That's because you're looking at the past 12 months and including the rises that were 6 months ago. If you look at the last 6 months, our inflation, or at least the U.S. inflation, is running closer to 3%. Inflation's already come back down. But when I look at kind of the tendency for voters to decide if they want to balance budgets and cut back on spending, it just doesn't seem to be there. One of the big things you could say is that you look at millennials. Millennials up until now have been kind of politically apathetic. They haven't gone out and voted, but they're coming out. They're actually, everyone talks about the boomers and how important they are. And they are important in that they own the most assets. But when you look at the actual numbers of the different generations, the millennials are by far the biggest. And as they become more involved and as they start holding the reins of power, I think you're going to find that they continue to spend more. And, you know, it's just, instead of getting all upset about it and arguing about whether it's right or not, I always just say to people, trade the market that you have, not the market you want. And that's what I suggest to people. Don't worry about whether it's right or wrong. Just say, you know, this is the reality of our economic situation. I have to adjust my portfolio accordingly.
Well, I've had this impression, and I think I've read it in your letter so many times. Don't trade the market the way you think it should be. Trade it the way you think it will be.
Right.
And I think you've just said that. Yeah, we can all hope that such and such will happen. But the reality does seem that governments, we look at the call it negotiations, to be polite, over the debt ceiling limit here. There's a group of a few Republicans who I think rightly so are saying, hey, we've got to rein in this spending, you know, and yet they're kind of painted as wild and crazy guys that, are willing to bankrupt the United States. I shouldn't say bankrupt, but cause the United States to default to, you know, sticking to their guns. But, you know, there is some sense to what they say. We have to at some point limit government spending, but the way I describe it, Kevin, it doesn't seem as though there is a political consensus in any way to stop that kind of spending.
Right. And I actually, one of the geopolitical analysts that I like, and I don't usually like geopolitical analysts because usually I find they just get you into trouble dreaming up all these terrible things and talking about things that have a low chance of occurring. But this fellow is named Marco Papich, and he's from Clock Tower Research, and he used to be at this great firm called BCA Research in Montreal.
Right.
And he talks about the median voter. And what the median voter, how their attitudes have changed. And he'll say that if you look at the median voter and take what they were interested in 2009, it was balancing the budgets. It was cutting back on spending. And you compare that to now, and the median voter has no interest in that. They're more interested in, ensuring that their society is more in the way that they want it to be, and they're prepared to spend to do that.
Yeah. Kevin, you are a trader as well as an analyst, and I think when I read your daily stuff, I think maybe you see yourself as a trader or investor first and an analyst second.
I would agree.
Okay. So let's talk. You wrote another piece recently that I thought was just terrific, and flat is a position too. And what you and I mean by flat is I don't have a trade on. You know, I'm just sitting here with cash and I'm scratching my head and I'm not sure I want to do anything. Tell us why flat is a position.
Well, the kind of most popular trade to talk about in terms of when you go around the world, it's the S&P 500. It is the biggest and most liquid market in the world. It represents what the economy of the largest and most prosperous country in the world has done. And it's also where people offset risk, like whether, you know, you be an Asian manager and you're looking to buy insurance for, let's just say, the market crash. You don't go and buy it on your index. You go buy it on the S&P 500. And too often we all feel, or at least me, you know, professional investors feel like they have to have a position in it. They have to have a view on the S&P 500. They have to say, I think it's going up or I think it's going down. And the point of the piece was to say that sometimes it's not that easy. And sometimes that you should just be, I don't really know where it's going. And not only that, there's better trades out there. One of my all-time kind of heroes of hedge fund managers that I love to watch and I hang on his every word is a fellow by the name of Stanley Druckenmiller. And Stanley Druckenmiller, along with George Soros, was the fellow that broke the Bank of England with the pound. And he's just an absolute fantastic risk taker. And he did a speech recently and he said, I have the lowest amount of positions that I've had in quite some time. And his whole argument is that I can leave my baseball bat on my shoulder and I don't need to swing at every pitch. And I'm waiting for a fatter pitch before I get excited about it. And I'm very sympathetic to that view. And the reason is because the S&P 500 is increasingly just a market of kind of five or six stocks. And those five or six stocks are those big tech stocks. So, you know, they were originally called the FANG mats. They were Facebook, Apple, Netflix, although Netflix is gone, Microsoft, Alphabet, and Tesla. And they've kind of moved around, and recently we've added NVIDIA. But we have this extremely narrow market where the increases that we've seen over the last 6 months have all been because of the rises in these stocks. And these stocks are just getting more and more expensive, and people are crowding into them. And I don't feel comfortable buying them. I don't want to buy them. I'm the first one to say that that there's a potential that there's a bubble being created. But the thing about bubbles is you got to be careful about shorting a bubble because it can go far, much farther than anyone thinks. So I just kind of looked at this and said, well, I don't want to buy those big stocks that represent 29% of the S&P 500 or something. And yet I'm looking around the world and I'm saying there's other kind of countries and other indexes that are doing quite well. And I just take Japan, for example. Japan just hit an all-time high, or not an all-time high, but a high for this move. The stocks are cheap. They're trading well. Most people are underweight them. And I think, why am I sitting around trying to, decide on what these five or six stocks are going to do when I can go buy something that is cheap that I feel much more comfortable with and that is actually behaving well? So I have kind of a wide variety of different non-US equities that I hold. And ultimately, one of the reasons that I think that people should be kind of broadening their investment horizon or investment the landscape that they think about things is that everyone is too overweight the U.S. market. And the reason that they're overweight the U.S. market is that for the last 10, almost 20 years, the U.S. has been the place to be. It has crushed everyone else. There's been no doubt about it. Like if you're a European pension fund manager and you weren't overweight U.S. equities, you no longer have a job. Same with a Japanese or a Swiss, you had to own U.S. equities. But the problem is that we've had all these people rushing into the U.S. Market. And so what I think it is, it's an over-owned, overbought, and too expensive market that it has a lot of risk in it. And I suspect that in the coming years, and maybe even over the next decade, that we will see a move out of the U.S. And it won't even be that they think that the rest of the world is so good. It's just that all that will be happening is that people will be reducing their portfolios back down to what's called benchmark. They were overweight the U.S., and just the move back to benchmark is going to be enough to have the U.S. underperform in the coming years.
Yeah, I think I saw on a market capitalization basis, the United States market was 70% of the world market. And I've saw the same trend that you did, that America, that like capital. Let me go this way. I talk about the U.S. dollar a lot. I trade currencies probably more than I trade stocks. And I describe the U.S. dollar as, money comes to America for safety and opportunity. I remember in the dot-com period, call it 98, 99, the U.S. dollar was just soaring as capital was coming to America because of the opportunities in the dot-com space that weren't available in other places in the world. And, you get these ebbs and flows from one market to another. Here's another sidebar. When you mentioned the Japanese market in your letter 2 weeks ago, I went and looked at it. I mean, I always have the Nikkei on my screen, but I hadn't been paying close attention. But you also mentioned the Mexican market. Now, from a currency trading perspective, I've been looking at the Mexican peso. Now, from 1995 until the COVID crisis in the spring of 2020, I think the peso lost about 75% of its value. But since then, the Mexican peso has been one of the strongest currencies in the world. And I kind of, my first take on that was, well, right these days, the short-term interest rate in Mexico is about 11.5% on 3 months Mexican paper compared to 5% in the United States. And I thought that was one of the reasons that the Mexican currency was doing so well. But when you alerted me to the Mexican stock market and I went and looked at it and it's at a 9-year high and it's been really ripping, I thought, oh, I bet you that's having some impact on the Mexican peso as well.
Oh, for sure. And the idea of why I was so excited about Mexico was that COVID, the crisis, put in motion what a lot of people are talking about is deglobalization. For, you know, the previous 30, 40 years, we saw more and more trade, an increasing amount of trade. We saw jobs moving over to China and stuff like that. But then all of a sudden, when COVID happened, we realized that there was negatives associated with this. All of a sudden, if you don't create your own, you know, medical supplies, that this could be scary. And then all combined with the Ukraine war, when all of a sudden it seemed to be that geopolitically we weren't as stable, and countries like the Europe that had relied on Russia to supply gas, all of a sudden that became even more kind of precarious and worrisome. So we have this kind of deglobalization happening, or people bringing, or countries bringing back manufacturing to their own shores for safety reasons. And when you look at that, there's also something called friendshoring. And friendshoring is groups of countries getting together and saying, we'll do this together. And the best kind of example of friendshoring is North America, the North America Free Trade Act. And you think back to the America, Canada, and Mexico. And for a while there in the 90s, it looked like Mexico was going to become the workshop of America, and all those things were going to get created there and done that. But then what happened was, China came along, they lowered their currency, they devalued to make their currency more competitive. And then not only that, they were admitted into the World Trade Organization, and they ate Mexico's lunch, in essence. Well, I think when you look at this deglobalization and this trend towards friendshoring, it means that Mexico is prime, like it's just set up to take advantage of becoming America's workplace again. And I suspect that when you look back, this was a great opportunity to buy Mexican stocks and their currency. You mentioned the fact that they have an 11% interest rate. Their inflation is way less than 11%, I believe. So I think that you're earning a positive return on that. And you can just own that outright. And it's a terrific trade in many different ways. And I think it's going to work for a variety of different reasons.
Kevin, you and I have both been traders for decades. When I go back, I always have a little bit of a nervousness about emerging markets. And nobody said it better than Donald Cox. And I think you know where I'm going with this. Donald Cox said, emerging markets are markets you cannot emerge from in an emergency. So I've always been a little bit nervous. I think I just want to play in domestic markets. By that, I mean Canada and the United States. And if I can't find an opportunity here, you know, I'll just go fishing or golfing or whatever it is. How do you deal with that? Like something could be happening in Japan or Mexico that you just have no idea. You just don't see it coming. Is it just, you know, you size your allocation to emerging markets, or how do you manage that?
Well, you do have to change your volatility, your positions based upon your volatility. And I also think that the world has changed. It used to be a lot harder to buy and sell Mexican stocks. And now you can get on your Interactive Brokers accounts and buy and sell it like in a heartbeat. Same with Japan. I was shocked. I didn't realize I traded my first Japanese stock. I'd never traded Japanese stocks. And when Warren Buffett in 2020 started buying these five, what they call trading houses, I said, well, I'm going to do this too. And Warren Buffett knows a lot more than me. And so I figured out the different numbers of the current of the stocks, because they don't have symbols there. They don't use letters. They use numbers. And I just got on there and I traded it. So I'm not quite as concerned as it used to be. And I think that that's just a function of the increased globalization of the financial markets. And you're in and out in a heartbeat. The only thing I would say is that, like, let's just go back to Russia, the time in the Russian situation when they went and invaded Ukraine. A lot of people started buying like the RSX, which was an ETF that was based upon the Russian stock market. And they were saying, let's cheap and blah, blah, blah. And they were telling us all about how, you know, there's no problem with this. And I said, you know, that to me isn't worth the risk. Like, there's a chance that we wake up tomorrow and that the government tells you you're not allowed to own that, which is exactly what happened. And I know people that are owning, they still own the RSX. They don't know how to get it off their sheets. It's going to be there for the rest of their lives. And it's a funny little aside. I have a little tag end of a short, meaning I was short the thing, and I can't get it off the sheets either. It sits there and it stares at me every day. So I view the underlying countries as more worrisome than just kind of putting all emerging markets together. And for like, I don't think that the risk of owning Chinese assets is worth it. And I'm kind of in your camp there. I'm saying, you know what? I understand the bull argument. I get it all. I'm just like, there's better things to own. I can buy Japan. I can go buy Mexico where I view there's less political risk. So I don't think you can put everything in one bucket like that. But I am sympathetic to that. There are some buckets that are more scarier than others. And those scary buckets, you definitely need to have the correct size position.
So I'm intrigued that you actually bought an individual Japanese stock rather than, say, a Japanese ETF or something. Do you do any sort of a currency hedge with that, or how do you handle that?
Well, no, I wanted the currency exposure, so I didn't do any hedge. I actually converted it, but you could do that if you felt that you wanted to be worried about the yen declining. But I'm actually a big Japanese yen bull as well, so I'll take that exposure. The other thing that I really like is the Japanese banks are super cheap, really, really cheap. And there's an ETF there that's I think the number is 1615, and what that is an ETF of all the Japanese banks. And I'm not very good at picking stocks in terms of doing the analysis to go through and decide this one's no good, this one's not that. So I wanted to trade an index. And for me, I couldn't find an index of Japanese banks that were listed in North America. So I went and found this one in Japan. And again, it was super easy. Just get on my Interactive Brokers and, you know, buy it like any other stock.
Now, Kevin, it occurs to me that we got to talk time frame here. I mentioned Joseph Schachter a few minutes ago when we were starting the show, how your dad and Jim used to work together. Now, Joseph has come on the radio show here with us many times over the years and talked about what he likes and what he doesn't like in the energy space. And for instance, I'm pretty short term with the trading that I do. My kind of ideal trading time horizons a few days to a few weeks. I think when I talk to Martin Murenbeel, our gold analyst, or Joseph Schachter, our energy analyst, they've got a much longer time frame than I have. When you're saying, for instance, that you want the exposure to the Japanese yen, I mean, I know the Japanese yen's been falling here the last couple of weeks, but that doesn't bother you because you've got a different time frame. Are all of your trades in the same time frame, or do you have different time frames for different things that you're doing?
No, so I do mix my time frames a lot, and it ends up being one of the difficulties and one of the challenges when you're writing something is to make sure you express and make it clear what time frame you're trading. And as a trader, it's also very difficult to keep it in kind of your time frames straight in your mind, because you know what's a trade that's gone? What's the definition of an investment? It's a trade that's gone wrong. And that's the real problem that you run into. So you have to make sure that you, when you're putting something on, that you have a definite time frame about it. And so I just mentioned those Japanese stocks that I own when Buffett bought them. I've held those for a couple of years, and I'll put those away. At the same time, I'll go and do a trade just like you that's one day, 2 days long, and I'll talk about that. And so I do mix my time frames a lot. I try to talk about longer term things that people can take advantage of as opposed to shorter term things. But there are like the occasional trade where I'll talk about, oh, there's an imbalance caused by this big option trade that's going to occur here. And this is something you can take advantage of for the next couple of days.
So if we go back to where we started, and just as a way to wrap up this interview, about the bond market, you were saying, you know, the bond market had a horrible year last year. The stock market had a horrible year. And for people who had a 60-40 portfolio of some kind, it was double horrible because of that. Right. With your longer term time frame on bonds, you basically, not to put words in your mouth, but you just said, I don't want to own them longer term. But you could see for that something could happen. Certainly, if we get any kind of a crisis in the market here, the bond market could go bid very aggressively.
I'm not even sure about that second half of the statement. Like, okay. That's how bearish I am. There are times that I will be kind of like, I think Dennis Gartman used to say, when you're bullish, there's only two things to be, or three positions to have. And it was like, if you're bullish, it's long, really long, or flat. And if you're bearish, there's only three positions, short, really short, or flat. And for me, I'm such a secular bond bear that when I get bullish on bonds, it's just basically I'm flat. And that's kind of how bearish I am. And one of the things that I really worry, because a lot of people made a lot of money throughout the last 40, 50 years by betting on the Fed lowering rates in times of crisis. And I'm not sure that that's going to be the go-to play. Then that's not where you're going to make your money. And I really think that people should think long and hard about what the inflation dynamic means. They should go study the 60s and the 70s and look at how things behave there. It behaved much differently. And I'll just say one thing. I just like kind of when you're thinking about bonds, this is how I like to explain it to people these days. In the 1970s, we had all sorts of inflation, and it went up, and it was like literally went down to 10 plus, and Volcker had to go and raise rates to kill inflation. And when he did that, the economy came to, slowed down, and inflation went down to very quickly went down to 2 or 3%. Yet what happened was that bonds, because everyone was so scared about inflation returning, bonds continued to offer what's called a high real yield. Meaning that, inflation was 3%, yet the 10-year bond market was trading at like 10%, meaning you could earn 7%. And that real yield took many years for it to finally decline until it went negative. I suspect what we're going to have is that whole process in reverse. We're going to be so convinced that tomorrow inflation is going to be gone. We're going to be back to the period like 2010 to 2020 when inflation is 0 to 2%, that people are overpaying for bonds and they're buying it and they're expecting this. And what they're going to find is their real yield, meaning their yield after inflation, will be dramatically worse than they're expecting.
Well, that's a hell of a point. And listen, that's a good point to wrap it up on. I appreciate you coming on the show with us today. I know we'll be asking you to come back again, but I think you and I are on the same page for bonds, but you're even more bearish than me, and that's pretty bearish. Kevin, thanks, buddy. I'm glad you could be with us today, and keep writing those great letters that now, if people want to see you, if they go to macrotourist.com, they can't see any of the things that you write.
You know, if they send me an email, just send me an email, kevin@themacrotourist.com, and I'll be more than happy to fire off some examples for them.
Oh, okay. That's super. So kevin@
themacrotourist.com.
Themacrotourist.com. Thanks for that. And good luck out there, my friend.
Thanks. Always great to chat with you, Victor.